We're continuing our discussion of proteins. And you remember we started talking about proteins as a very basic unit, which was amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, which are polymers. And then we talked about the structure of proteins, how they have primary, secondary, tertiary, and some of them, like hemoglobin, have quaternary structure. And now, then we went on from that and we introduced the concept of the different types of proteins, such as globular and structural fibrous proteins. And today we're going to start talking about a very specific type of globular protein, which we call enzymes. And we briefly introduced the concept of enzymes at the beginning of the semester. And basically what they are then is biological catalysts. So they pretty much act like any catalyst that you had defined before, and that is it speeds up a reaction. And as you look at the first picture, you can see it does that by lowering the energy of activation. And it is not consumed in the reaction, but instead it just lowers that energy of the transition state, lowers the energy of activation. You can see in the picture the uncatalyzed versus enzyme catalyzed reaction. So it's not consumed in the reaction, so it basically binds with the substrate and produces product, and it does it efficiently, or catalyzes it, does it faster by lowering the energy of activation. Enzymes are really, really specific for what substrate they bind. They also display what we call a high degree of reaction specificity. That means that they only catalyze, only bind certain substrates, and only work in very specific or certain reactions. And this, of course, discourages wasteful byproducts, because we wouldn't want active enzymes all over the place catalyzing a variety of things. So they're very, very specific. As we mentioned before, they often need a cofactor to be fully active. And the cofactors we talked about come in two kinds, two types, organic and inorganic cofactors. Inorganic cofactors are things like metals, iron, magnesium, manganese. Organic cofactors can be either coenzymes or prosthetic groups. And we saw a really detailed example of a prosthetic group in myoglobin and hemoglobin. That was the heme group. And remember, an organic cofactor, a prosthetic group, does never leave the enzyme. It's a permanent part of the structure of the enzyme. A coenzyme, of which we will see a lot in the coming couple of weeks, are generally vitamins. So they are also organic cofactors, but they are vitamins. And they come and go and are part of the enzyme when it's fully active, but they're not there otherwise. So a little bit different than the covalently bound prosthetic group. We will see as we start to examine metabolic pathways, which we will do the last several weeks of the semester, that there's always going to be one reaction or one specific enzyme that's going to be rate limiting for the whole pathway. And so as we look at the pathways, we will always state this is the rate limiting step. It's usually within the first one or two reactions of a pathway. And so there'll be a specific enzyme that's particularly important for the pathway and determines the rate of the pathway. Kind of keeps the pathway moving at the correct rate. So again, in your first picture there, it's just a simple reaction pathway that you've all seen before where you start with reactants and go to products. And again, the thing to notice is that the enzyme lowers the energy of activation and is not consumed in the reaction. You also notice that this is what's called an exothermic, or biochemists call it an exergonic reaction. So that means the energy level of the reactants is higher than the products. This is a spontaneous reaction. So we'll have a negative delta G associated with it. There are a number of types of enzyme reactions, and I've listed most of the types that we will encounter here. And these are the general types of enzyme reactions. And generally, again, the name, the type of reaction will give you an idea of the chemistry that's going on. Another thing you'll notice about each of the bold-lettered names of these types of enzyme reactions is they all end in A-S-E. So again, most of the enzymes we will see, and we will see many, end in the letters A-S-E. So they have transferases. It pretty much does what you would think. It transfers a chemical group from one molecule to another. Hydrolases cleave something, so they lyse something, and they use water, hence hydro, so hydrolysis. Oxidoreductases, those are oxidation reduction, reaction. So these are enzymes that are involved in transfer of electrons between molecules. So in terms of chemistry, oxidizing something, reducing something. A lyase, again, is something that breaks something apart or lyses it. And this, in this instance, it would be without water or oxygen. It's called a lyase rather than a hydroxylase or a hydrolase. A ligase is another type of enzyme, and it catalyzes two things coming together, generally via the elimination of water. A good example is making a peptide bond, taking two amino acids. We ligate them together, and again, we do that with the elimination of water. And the last type of enzyme reaction we'll see is an isomerase. And an isomerase catalyzes the rearrangement of a substrate, and the best way to think of that is things going from cis to trans or trans to cis. An example you've seen in organic chemistry, those are isomers. That's what an isomerase would do. So some of the language we need to be able to talk about kinetics of enzymes, which is what we want to do today. And on Wednesday we will start to talk about specific types of enzymes called isozymes and non-functional plasma enzymes. And then we will end up a week from today on Monday talking about enzyme mechanisms, so how they work, and we'll focus on one specific one. So again, some of the language of biochemistry is that we call things exergonic instead of exothermic. But it basically means the same thing as you probably learned in first year chemistry. In other words, the energy level of the reactants is higher than the product. It's a spontaneous reaction. The free energy change will be negative. Almost all of the reactions in biochemistry will be exergonic, spontaneous reactions with negative delta G's. When we start to look at pathways, however, we will see within a pathway there can be an endergonic or endothermic reaction. And usually that reaction will be coupled to a highly exothermic, highly negative delta G reaction, which will have enough energy to drive itself and also push that one or two endergonic reactions that we might see in a pathway. But for the most part, everything will be exothermic. So in other words, all of the pathways that we talk about will proceed spontaneously. Again, this is an example or a picture of an endergonic or endothermic reaction. And again, the difference there, reactants, energy level is lower than product, so we need to put energy into the system for the reaction to proceed. The delta G of this type of reaction is positive. So it's not a spontaneous reaction. It needs something to push it. As we talk about kinetics of enzymes, temperature is not really a factor in terms of biochemistry. If we raise the temperature of a system, we know it increases the energy level of the molecules. So they start jumping around much, much faster and, of course, interact much more frequently. So the number of collisions they have with each other is much more frequent, so they have much more reaction. Well, the body operates, of course, within a very narrow temperature range. Much like pH, the range tends to be very narrow. And so, actually, temperatures have very little effect on enzymes. If, however, you have a fever, particularly a high fever, then the rate of all your metabolic pathways generally increase. So in that case, temperature will come in to play, and it actually raises the energy demands of your body. Your body actually needs extra energy when you have something like a fever, which also makes sense in the fact that your body's fighting something off. Generally, it's some sort of symbol that your immune system is extremely busy, back to antibodies and antigens, fighting something. And some of you that are old enough or may have parents or grandparents that say things, a phrase called feeding a fever, and they try to get you to consume things when you are sick or have a fever, and that's because there's actually fact behind it, your energy demands do go up. So that's the only instance in which temperature will really affect kinetics of enzymes, because normally, of course, our temperature is in quite a narrow range. This is a really simple picture of enzyme kinetics. And basically, it simply shows that we start with some substrate and its concentrations decrease as product increases. So basically, it's your most simple picture of a reaction. You have a substrate or a reactant, and over time, it becomes product. And that's all this picture is showing. We can begin to talk about this picture and actually the next picture. And to do that, we have to talk about something called the Michaelis-Menten equation. The name's not particularly significant, except obviously the scientists who discovered it were named Michaelis and Menten. And the Michaelis-Menten equation, as written in your notes, is V equals V max times the substrate concentration divided by Km plus substrate concentration. Now, what do all the terms in the equation mean? V is velocity, which is basically just a different term for rate. Biochemists call it velocity. It's basically the rate of the reaction. V max is when all of the enzyme molecules have substrate bound, so it's basically the maximum that the enzyme can do. So that's the maximal velocity. You can't get any more out of it. S with the brackets is the concentration of the substrate. And the Km, as defined mathematically, is the concentration of the substrate needed to give half of the maximum velocity. Half of the maximum velocity. We will not think of Km, though, in terms of the mathematical definition, but we will think of it instead in terms of, it is a measure of affinity of the enzyme for its substrate. So as we talk about Km's, we're going to talk about the concept of affinity, how much the enzyme likes its substrate. So some enzymes have very great affinity for substrate, and they go seeking it out all the time. And some of them have pretty low affinity. In other words, you've got to have a whole lot of the substrate around before they take notice. So we're going to talk about it as a concept of affinity rather than its mathematical version. But as we look at it in a graph, you can see the rate versus the substrate concentration. And again, overall, what's happening is we're turning substrate into product. And you can see as you go along the curve, eventually you hit 100%. You hit a maximum rate. And then there you can see the Km defined mathematically, and that's the substrate concentration that we need to achieve half of the maximum rate for an enzyme. The Michaelis-Menten equation is not all that useful in a lab setting to deal with data, but it is more useful to be able to look at graphs, look at things graphically, and so when we do enzyme kinetics, to be able to graph it. So again, another name, not particularly significant, Lineweaver-Burke, who took the Michaelis-Menten equation and discovered that if they inverted it, they could do some simple math and end up with the equation of a line. And so basically what I put on the board here is the steps in inverting this equation. It's really very simple algebra. So we take Michaelis-Menten and invert it, and then using the common denominator, I basically split out the Km from the S. Over here, notice the S's cancel. And what you end up with is that 1 over V is equal to Km over V max times 1 over the substrate concentration plus 1 over V max. And that is the same as saying Y equals MX plus B. So now we can look at all these values on a graph, and we know that M is the slope and B is the y-intercept. So as we look at that graphically, we have a Lineweaver-Burke plot. This is a typical Lineweaver-Burke plot for an enzyme. You'll notice now that the y-axis is 1 over V, x-axis is 1 over the concentration of the substrate. The slope of the line is Km over V max. So that's M, remember, when you look at y equals mx plus B. Now, one thing you want to notice as you look at one of these lines, and I'm trying to remember if you do this in the lab. If you don't this semester, if you take the second semester lab, we do a lot of enzyme kinetics. But as you look at this plot, you need to remember it's an inverse plot. So as the line moves, and we're going to actually play with these plots and look at inhibition in a minute, as the line moves, so as this line moves up and down on the y-axis, as it moves up the y-axis, it actually means we're decreasing the maximal velocity. As it moves down, we're increasing the maximal velocity. So you'll notice that the intercept, which again is coming right from the equation, B being the y-intercept, is 1 over V max. So because it's inverse, it's kind of not how we usually think. Usually as that line goes up the axis, we're increasing a value, but in this case we're decreasing it. And it's the same for the x-intercept, or what is known as 1 over Km. As this line starts to move closer towards zero, that actually means the Km, or affinity, of the enzyme for its substrate is increasing. As you move away, the affinity is decreasing. So if you plot these in the lab and start to look at different plots, which we will look at two examples, you have to remember in your mind what the plot is actually telling you. So we're talking everything inverses now when we look at Lineweaver-Burk. So enzymes, again, biological catalysts, they're proteins, globular proteins, mean they contain an active site, which is where they bind substrate. Most all of them need a cofactor to be fully active, and they're very, very specific. Their kinetics is pretty simple, but now we want to talk about a concept that is particularly important in the pharmaceutical industry, and that is inhibitors of enzymes. The pharmaceutical industry is particularly interested in developing drugs that are inhibitors of enzymes. So in other words, there's some product, which is something bad, that we don't want in our biochemistry. How can we stop that from being made? Well, we can inhibit its enzyme, and that will, at the least, slow it down greatly, and in the best case, stop it from being formed altogether. So drugs are often inhibitors of enzymes. So there's two types of inhibition that can happen, that we can have. One is called competitive inhibition. And in a competitive inhibitor binds to the active site of the enzyme. So I drew a picture of kind of what's happening, E being the enzyme, S the substrate, I the inhibitor. You take the enzyme, you add competitive inhibitor to it, that inhibitor binds directly to the active site of the enzyme. That means that the substrate can't bind there, because it goes to bind and its active site is filled by this inhibitor. So if you look at the kinetics of what happens with a competitive inhibitor, and basically what you're seeing is the two lines. The solid line is basically the same graph as we saw above. That's a typical Lineweaver-Burk plot. The dashed line is an enzyme with competitive inhibitor added to it. And you will notice it doesn't change the maximal velocity of the enzyme at all. But what it does change greatly is the Km. So notice on the x-axis how far that line moved. And again, it's moving towards zero. But because we're inverse, we're talking about it's increasing the Km. And remember, Km is a measure of affinity of enzyme for its substrate. So as we increase the Km, this enzyme, which now has inhibitor bound in its active site, actually loses its affinity or its desire to bind substrate. And basically it can't bind substrate because there's something bound in its active site. So it's a very effective way to stop the enzyme from working. If we do this, basically we will not form product. So this is ideal. This is what pharmaceuticals like to develop as a drug, as a competitive inhibitor. Competitive inhibitor, something that binds to the active site of the enzyme, stops substrate from binding, greatly, greatly decreases the enzyme's affinity for its substrate. Okay, so it's increasing the VM, didn't change the maximal velocity. The other type of inhibition is not quite as clean. It's called non-competitive inhibition. And again, I drew a picture where E now is the enzyme, S is the substrate, I is the inhibitor. The first part of the picture looks similar to competitive. In other words, we have some enzyme with inhibitor bound in its active site. But what we have added to the picture is this complex over here. That is enzyme with substrate bound, with inhibitor bound also. And what that's implying to us is that a non-competitive inhibitor binds somewhere on the enzyme other than the active site. So a non-competitive inhibitor is not competing directly for the active site. Instead, it's glomming itself onto the enzyme somewhere else. So it is possible to have enzyme with substrate bound and inhibitor bound. So it's not quite as clean. As you look at the graph for this type of inhibition, again, you'll notice the solid line being the normal enzyme kinetics and the dashed line being an enzyme with a non-competitive inhibitor added to it. You will notice this time you do have a change in the maximal velocity, and we've actually decreased it, decreased the maximal velocity. So what the non-competitive inhibitor really does is drags on the enzyme. binds somewhere else other than the active site, causes some sort of conformational change, and is dragging or slowing the enzyme from attaining its maximal velocity. You'll notice also that the Km changed very slightly. So in other words, the affinity decreased a little bit. The Km went up, the affinity decreased just slightly. And again, that's probably from the conformational change. So when this non-competitive inhibitor gets a hold of the enzyme, the whole structure of the protein shifts a bit, changes the shape of the active site, and perhaps then the substrate cannot bind quite as easily or recognize the active site quite as easily. Km apparent, you'll notice that on both of these graphs or Lineweaver-Burk plots, Km apparent, basically that just means it's different than Km. So in other words, we're making a distinction, Km being the affinity of the enzyme for its substrate without any inhibitor added, and Km apparent is the affinity of the enzyme for its substrate with an inhibitor added. And you see it's the same in both, so it's Km apparent if you add competitive inhibitor or non-competitive inhibitor. It's just a distinction as we look at the Lineweaver-Burk plot so we know which of those lines is the normal enzyme kinetics and which is kinetics with an inhibitor added to it. K catalysis is the rate at which an enzyme catalyzes a single reaction. Not overly important, but it's another definition that goes along kind of with the kinetics of enzymes, or enzyme kinetics. So this is a basic introduction, and we're going to do a case study today. Hopefully you printed it out. If you did not print it out, you can do it later. We'll just go through it and you can jot down notes. But again, kind of reviewing before we look at the case study, again, we're talking about globular proteins. So it's a type of protein, and you have to keep in mind it has a primary, secondary, tertiary structure, and it has an active site where it binds substrate. So that's what an enzyme is. And again, it is a catalyst. It lowers the energy of activation of a reaction. It's not consumed in the reaction. Enzyme kinetics are the Michaelis-Menten equation, and more importantly for biochemists, the Lineweaver-Burk equation, which allows us to look at plots or graphs of enzyme kinetics. Then more importantly to the pharmaceutical industry or in terms of developing drugs or treatments for certain diseases or disorders is the whole concept of inhibition. And again, the cleanest thing to get is a competitive inhibitor because it's nice and neat. It binds to the active site of the enzyme and basically stops the substrate from binding. So you stop product production. Not quite as neat as non-competitive because it doesn't bind at the active site, but it binds at some other site, basically slows down the enzyme, and also reduces its affinity for substrate a bit. So two types of inhibition. Again, a concept, if you take the second semester lab, we will look at inhibition of enzymes. This case study basically relates in general to enzymes and to a specific enzyme. And I'm first going to read through it. If you don't have a copy of it, you can look on with someone else. And then we'll answer, there's just three short questions for this one. You can look it up here, obviously, just to read it. So again, they're real case studies from a book. BB is an 18-year-old male, presents to his doctor's office with a year-long history of gas and diarrhea. Discomfort began a year ago, occurred on average once per month. But then the symptoms now have been getting worse and occur at least once a week. This must be an old case study because he talks about his severe episodes occurring following ice cream dates with his girlfriend. And he doesn't seem to notice these symptoms when he eats like meat and vegetables or other foods. So he looks normal, physical examination, electrolytes, blood count, urinalysis, everything's normal. So they admit him to the hospital and do a barium contrast, upper, lower GI, everything's normal. There's really basically nothing that they can find significant. So they give him two large glasses of milk, and of course, within short order, his symptoms develop. So basically, this is, I particularly picked this one because a lot of people suffer from this. It's called lactose intolerance. And how it relates to the enzyme is, lactose is milk sugar. And in order to break down the carbohydrate lactose or milk sugar, you need an enzyme called lactase. That's again ASE, we know it's an enzyme. And lactase basically takes the sugar from milk, so we're talking about cheese, any kind of dairy product that contains lactose, and breaks it into glucose and galactose. So lactose is a disaccharide, breaks it into two monosaccharides. Patient's ethnicity may play an important role in this problem, because it turns out so it turns out ethnicity plays a role in lactose intolerance, and it turns out that most people of Oriental descent are lactose intolerant to one degree or another. It is almost 100% in the population. American Indians, almost the same. African Americans, about 81%. Italians, which I find a little weird, but 71%, and Latinos, about half of the population, has some degree of lactose intolerance. And then Western Europeans, or what I call white, have the lowest degree of lactose intolerance, and about 25%, or about a quarter of the population. It is also noticeable that it has an age relation. So sometimes people are fine, and as they age or get older, their lactose intolerance increases, sometimes greatly. And so basically what's happened is that when they were young, their lactase was active and present, and for some reason it stops either being active or it is in too low concentrations to be effective, and so they develop a lactose intolerance, or it gets worse as they age. So again, it causes, it's not particularly dangerous, but very uncomfortable. Mostly solved for the most part. You can buy milk pretty much in every grocery store now that has lactase added to it. Or you can take lactase in some sort of pill form or put drops in dairy products. And so you can basically add lactase to your diet and then be able to tolerate dairy products. Can the condition occur in infants? Yes. A baby can be born lactose intolerant, usually some sort of genetic problem so that they don't code for that particular protein, because remember the enzyme is a protein, lactase, and hence why there are soy formulas, alternative proteins, other formulas based on different proteins other than milk proteins. So yes, it can occur in infants.